I had a reading in the public library. Tonight I have another reading in a bookstore and company. And tomorrow I'm going to see some friends. Is that okay? Yeah.
Keep going.
And
what are you doing Thursday?
Thursday? I think I'll see some friends again, you know, and I hope to reach a gentleman who is with the Ford Foundation because I want to pump him for some money.
Futile message on the
yeah. Hope that wasn't taped.
Well, I've been clipping a lot of articles and things about you. You certainly be getting a lot of publicity here in the States. And it's a wonderful book. I'm not quite finished with it, but it's very easy to read, and it's fun to read, and it sheds a lot of light about not only about yourself, of course, but about your life in Czechoslovakia and what you're doing now. I think the first thing I'd like to ask you is the definitive pronunciation of your name.
My name? Well, it's an old Czech name, and I don't know anybody by the same name. The pronunciation is Škvorecký. Škvorecký. The first sound is sh, not s, because...
Škvorecký.
Škvo.
I'm not saying I sang that correctly. Škvorecký.
Škvo. It's like square or square, so it's Škvorecký.
Well, I'll have to practice that. The name of your hero, Danny...
Smiřický. Smiřický, yes.
All right.
And that's because the family of Škvorecký was a branch of the family of Smiřický, you know. So that's why I named him after the main stem of the family.
Well, it's going to take a little practice on my part to get it so I pronounce it correctly on the air. You were 15 years old when the Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia. What was German occupation like for you?
Well, for me personally, it wasn't so dreadful because it started when I was a boy, you know, and then I was a student and we played jazz and all that, and except for the fact that my father was arrested at one time, but then he was released after about 2 months. So I personally did not suffer very much. But of course it was a time of Nazi occupation and many people were killed and executed, sent to camps, parents of my friends and so on. So we did know about the horrors. But I was living in a small town in occupied Bohemia, and the treatment of the Bohemians, of the Czechs, was very different from, for instance, the treatment of the Poles, because Bohemia is a heavily industrialized country with many armament factories, and the Germans simply needed the Czech working class to produce guns and tanks and things like that. So they were using, you know, velvet gloves. And of course, people got arrested and shot, but these were mainly intellectuals who tried to organize some anti-Nazi movement, and there were many of them. But in Poland, as you know, the terror was indiscriminate. They didn't need the Poles, you know. They had no industry, they only had agriculture, so they were just shooting them literally in the streets. That never happened in Czechoslovakia except for that period after the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich, the Nazi Reich Protector of Bohemia and Moravia, who was, I think, number three in the Nazi party. And he was assassinated by Czech and Slovak parachutists sent from England. And after his assassination, there followed about 2 months of real terror, about 5,000 political executions, which were announced every day on posters, you know. And, of course, the village of Lidice, if you probably heard about it. Again, people pronounce it in different ways. They say Lidice or whatever. So it was a small mining village, and the miners there hit one of the paratroopers. And after the war, it came out that this was not a real paratrooper, but an agent provocateur. And the Nazis simply surrounded the village and shot all men older than 15 years. So if you were 15 years, you qualified as a man. They shot all of them, and they sent all the women to Ravensbrück. That was a female concentration camp. And they sent all the children for adoption to childless German families. So most of the women returned after the war, but Very few of the children did return because many of them were small children who simply forgot about their families, and they probably are still living in Germany. They will be now, you know, in their 50s or so.
Did your father have the same kind of leg wound that Danny's father did in the book?
Yes, that's a more or less accurate portrait of what happened to my father. He died as the last victim of World War I, at least last in Bohemia, because he was wounded in 1917, and he died in 1967 after an operation on that leg, you know. They tried to do something with the wound, and the operation took about 3 or 4 hours, and he simply died of a heart failure.
Your hero, Danny, in the Engineer of Human Souls, worked in a Messerschmitt factory, and I understand you did as well. Can you tell me about that? I understand, according to some of the material I read, that you had come up with a scheme to sabotage the planes.
Yes, well, it was a sort of rather stupid scheme, you know, but again, the description of that thing is quite accurate in the novel. You know, after the raid started on Germany, so the Germans dislocated their industries. That was, you know, a plan worked out by the German Minister of Industry, who was one of the few who were not executed after the war. So they dislocated the armaments industry, and one of the factories in my native town became part of the Messerschmitt complex, and they did produce parts of the Messerschmitt fighter, and also of the Stuka dive bomber and of the V1, the V1 weapon. So I worked in that factory, and I simply got this idea of tampering with the drillings. And I did it mainly because I wanted to show off. There was this girl, and I did it. But fortunately, the Czech foreman found out, not a German one. If it had been a German, so I suppose it would be much worse. But this Czech foreman simply tried to put it right. It's described in the book. I wouldn't do it nowadays, because when I was young, you simply don't think about the consequences, you know. I'm just, I hadn't had any bad experience at the time, so I just did it. Yes, that.
You planned to enter college as a, I guess, a medical student, right? You were studying the natural sciences, I guess. What happened? How did you change from something so down-to-earth to something much lofty intellectually?
Well, I didn't see it as something down-to-earth. Right after the war, you know, I decided, because I saw all these people who were returning from the concentration camps, and many of them were very seriously ill, and they had to be hospitalized and suffered and so on. So because I was young, and when you are, you know, young, you are an idealist, so I got this idea that the only human vocation that makes any sense is medicine, helping sick people. So I worked in the hospital over the summer, and then I enrolled at the medical school, but of course I was unable to memorize anything. So in the first semester you have to study anatomy, which means mainly memorizing the Latin names of bones and muscles and things. And I was simply unable to remember those, you know. So after one semester, and there was chemistry on top of that and biology, and all these subjects means a lot of memorizing. And I never could remember anything that had no concrete human content, you know. I could very well remember stories and things like that, but not names of bones. So after one semester, I saw that simply it wasn't possible, and I switched over to philosophy.
Well, through philosophy and through your writing, first you've given some medicine to our souls, as opposed to medicine to our bodies. So in many respects, I think we're grateful that you made that switch. You got into publishing, however, in Czechoslovakia. How did that happen?
Well, I was an editor in a publishing house. Well, I graduated from the university in 1949, and at that time there was a governmental decree that all graduates of the philosophical faculty had to teach school. And I never wanted to teach school, you know. I just wanted to be a writer. But I had to teach for almost 2 years, and then I was drafted into the army, and while I was there, I contacted some friends with who knew about my writing, and they got me this job in the publishing house. We were, you know, there was in the early 50s, there was a rather lively underground in Prague, literary underground. We had groups of fiction writers and poets and musicians and whatnot, and we would meet, you know, in private apartments and discuss things and so on. And we also helped each other, and some of us, you know, held positions, because some of us were party members who they didn't agree with the party line in those days, because that was the Stalinist party and the Stalinist aesthetics. But they, of course, kept their membership in the party, and they helped the others. So by with the help of one such friend, I got a position of editor in a publishing house. And since I studied English literature, so I became an editor of American classics, mainly.
Mm.
And I worked there for 10 years altogether.
Tell me about your first book. It was The Cowards in 1958. How did that come about?
Well, there was a book that I wrote while I was still a student at the university. I wrote it in 1948, which was the year of the communist takeover, and I finished it in 49. But I knew that this type of fiction was unpublishable at that time, because it went against all the rules of socialist realism. So I just kept it in my desk drawer, and I waited for better times to come, and when I thought they came, I offered it for publication. Before that, I offered another book for publication, which was called The End of the Nylon Age. And that was first accepted, but then banned by the censorship before publication. It was deemed to be a pornography. Of course, there was nothing pornographic about it. It was really politically not acceptable. And then The Cowards came out and were on in bookstores for about a month. And then the police seized all copies. That is, all copies they could put their hands on, because when the book started being attacked by reviewers on command from the party, so the publishers just hid all their copies, you know.
What was the theme of The Cowards?
Well, that's a novel about the last few days of World War II in a small Czech town. You know, the Germans are retreating and the Red Army is coming, and everything is observed through the eyes of a young student who plays the tenor saxophone in a local jazz band. And that, of course, was not the right approach, because such a solemn theme should have been observed through the eyes of a good communist or something like that. And this was just a student who loved jazz and who loved girls and who just wanted to play and enjoy life. So that was thought to be, you know, slanderous and decadent and cosmopolitan and Zionist. It was, all these labels were put on me, you know. They spoke in the reviews. I was labeled an anti-Semite and a Zionist at the same time, you know, and a Trotskyite and revisionist and a social democrat and whatever. And of course, degenerate and decadent. And they have a large repertoire of labels, you know, and they keep repeating them. So the book was banned, and I was fired from my position as editor. By the time I was editor of a literary magazine, and I was fired, and all the editors who were responsible for the publication of the book were fired, about seven of them, you know, the editor-in-chief, the director of the publishing house, the editor who did the actual book, and then the man who handled the promotion, about seven people.
Sounds like the American publishing industry.
Well, if I don't know, of course people get fired everywhere, but I don't think anybody would be fired in America for a book like this, because it was such an innocent book, you know, which really was not offensive to anybody's moral or religious or political feelings. It was just about jazz and youth and the end of the world.
How did you wind up in Toronto?
Well, that's not an accident. I had a friend who left Czechoslovakia when the Nazis came with his family. He was a boy. It was a Jewish family. And this man then in the war grew up and of course became a soldier and returned to Czechoslovakia with General Patton's army, you know, as a soldier. And of course we were reunited, and then after the Soviet invasion, when I realized that I couldn't stay in Czechoslovakia because there would be no future for me as a writer. So I wrote to him, and he had another friend who was the chairman of the Slavic department of the University of Toronto, and this lady invited me for a series of lectures, and people liked those lectures, so I got an offer from the English department from the University of Toronto. So it was not a matter of choice, I just got this offer.
Have any difficulty in leaving?
No, not at that time, because after the Soviet invasion, which came in August 1968, Dubček remained in office for another 9 months. He didn't really wield any real power, you know, but he still had power to decide about minor matters, such as who will get a passport and who will not. And he issued warnings to quite a few people who had been active in publicly during his brief reign, that he no longer could guarantee their safety. And so I simply got a passport and got out on a passport.
What's it like for you as a writer living in a Western democracy compared to Czechoslovakia?
Well, my feelings can be described only in very strong terms. I'll just tell you that in my 20 years of writing in Czechoslovakia, I wrote fewer books than in my 14 years in North America. Because there is simply no censorship here, you know. I don't feel threatened. I can write freely. I know that this word freedom is misused very often, but I think in the case of us exiles, it has a real validity. Because, you know, in Czechoslovakia, when I was very young, I just wrote for the desk drawer. I didn't think about publishing. I knew that this was impossible. But then when you get older, you want to have some contact with the readers and some recognition. And you start self-censoring yourself, you know. You start writing a book and you have good ideas, but you know that these good ideas would never pass the censor. So you either abandon them or twist them or write around them and try to write between the lines, which is not so easy as some people think, and you feel restricted. Whereas here in the West, I just wrote as I could, and the only restriction was the limits of my talent, you know.
You're not only writing, but you're publishing. You have your own publishing firm in Toronto.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, that was my wife's idea, because when we came, she didn't have any English. Her languages were Russian and French, and she naively thought that Canada, being a bilingual country, would be easy for her because she spoke French very well. Of course, when she started speaking French in Toronto, they thought that she was speaking Czech, because nobody speaks French in Toronto. So the first 2 years for her were very difficult, you know. She learned English in a very painstaking manner. And then she got this idea of starting a publishing house, because I got an offer from a Czech organization in the States that they would publish some book of mine. And she said, well, why should you publish it with someone else? We can start our own publishing house. This is possible in North America. This is a capitalist society. It's not necessary to come to a state-owned publishing house. There are no such houses. So she started a business, and we published a book of mine, a novel, a satirical novel called The Tank Corps, which is a satire on the army. And of course, satires on the army always are successful, because people like to, especially at least the Czechs, like to read about the army, and they like people who make fun of the army. So we sold altogether about 9,000 copies, which for an emigre publishing house is really a big bestseller.
Now, the books that you publish, are they all in Czech?
They are all in Czech, yes. We publish it for the Czech communities all over the Western world.
Is there a big enough market?
Well, the market is not very big, but there is a tradition among the Czechs of reading fiction, you know, which is much stronger than, for instance, in North America. The type of people in North America who would never think of reading a novel, read novels in Czech. That goes back to the 19th century when the Czech language was almost extinct, you know, and the patriots who themselves spoke very poor Czech, their language was German. started promoting Czech, first by translating books, mainly English novels like Dickens. You know, Dickens was a very popular author in Bohemia in the 19th century, and they by writing their own. So that people considered reading Czech books almost a patriotic duty in the 19th century. You know, a person, an educated man or woman, who would not read fiction was looked down upon as someone who is not patriotic enough. And that developed into a habit. And by now, simply people have this habit. And then, you know, in the past 50 years, the Czech nation has lived under dictatorships, with censorship, with many books being banned. So the books became forbidden fruit. And as soon as something becomes forbidden fruit, everybody wants to have it. So by now, the passion for reading fiction became a part of the national character.
Well, you even publish by your own publishing firm, The Engineer of Human Souls, is that right? Before
yes.
It was before the trade edition, or the
yes.
English edition?
Yes, that came out in 1977 in Czech. And it took about 5 years to be translated, because it's not an easy book to translate.
Do you write exclusively in Czech?
Well, I write non-fiction in English. I have written 2 books on film, on the cinema, in English. The latest one is called Jiří Menzel and the History of the Closely Watched Trains. That's the movie that was awarded the Oscar Award in 1968. And I write articles, I write reviews for The New Republic, for instance, in English. I'm sure they have to correct it, you know, brush it up. But I wouldn't dare to write fiction in English, you know, that's too difficult.
Because of various nuances?
Well, because you have to know the language really. You have to be absolutely at home in the language. You have to be absolutely at home in the idiomatic usage, you know. And that is hardly possible for someone who grew up and who was 45 when I left Czechoslovakia. So I can never hope to feel at home in English to the extent I feel at home in Czech.
Well, the translation is done extremely well. I can't remember the name of the translator.
Paul Wilson.
Paul Wilson. And it reads so naturally, so easily. You have read this in English?
Yes, obviously. Well, I worked with him. I just read it after him and we discussed things. Well, he is, I think, an ideal translator because he is Canadian. There is nothing Czech about him. I think that his father is Irish and his mother is English or something. But after he graduated from the University of Toronto, he went to Europe for 1 year, as most students would. And he ended up in Prague, and he stayed there for 10 years. And he learned Czech not from books or in courses, but by becoming a member of an underground rock and roll group, you know, a rock group called the Plastic People of the Universe. He was their singer. And he became quite a star in the underground, because he sang in English, you know. And so he learned idiomatic Czech. So his Czech is very good. And he also learned about the atmosphere and he learned about the quality of life. He learned what it means to be a citizen of a totalitarian dictatorship. He never became a citizen, but he lived with the others. And eventually the whole group was arrested, and they received terms in jail, you know, 2 to 3 years. But since he was a Canadian citizen, the government decided that it would be counterproductive to send him to jail, because that would mean that the Canadian ambassador would intervene and so on. So they just kicked him out of the country.
Is it possible for you to have written the book, as you did, in Czech, and then translate it yourself into English? Is that feasible?
No, that would be such hard labor, and the result would not be good. Because, you know, if I were a writer like Franz Kafka or somebody like that, and if I wrote in very bookish Czech, then it would be possible. But my Czech is very, very idiomatic, you know, very vernacular. I like to write in slangs, and I use argots and dialects, local dialects. And this is something that I can never hope to achieve in English.
Did the translation process put any particular difficulty on the shoulders of your editor? Who did she work with directly?
Well, with the translator and with me. You know, we had consultations, constant consultations about the difficult passages and It was fun, you know. I like to work very closely with my editor and the translator, because you find, by this sort of collaboration, you find solutions to many problems. You know, translation is a craft, and there are many problems. You know, some people have this naive idea that if you know a foreign language, you can translate from it. But that's not true. Because if you know only that language and you know nothing about the technique of translation, you just produce something that is full of Anglicism, if you translate from English, or Bohemicisms, if you translate from Czech, and it doesn't read naturally, as this translation does. So you have to know quite a lot about linguistics, and you have to have a good experience in translating. And because the other language, you know, always seduces you to translate it literally. And for instance, in English, the passive voice is quite common. I was told. In Czech, you cannot say, I was told. That is, you can say it grammatically, but it doesn't sound Czech, you know. You can see that this is a translation.
What do they say?
they told me. They told me. He told me. She told me. Never I was told, you know. And that's only one of many instances. So it's difficult. And as with every craft, if you have two or three people who consult the things, so chances are that the results will be better.
Did you find the translator yourself?
Yes, it's a long story, because when he never wanted to stay in Czechoslovakia forever, you know. He just wanted to stay there as long as possible and then come back to Canada and make a living as a translator or journalist. And when he saw that they were after him, so he sent word to his father whether he would not be able to find someone who could introduce him to some Czech circles that would give him, you know, work. And his father learned about our publishing house, and so he contacted me and told me about him. And that was at the time when I was looking for a translator, or my editor was. And so when Paul was kicked out, and he was in London, England, waiting for his wife, who is Czech, and at first they didn't want to let her out. But fortunately, by the time she was pregnant, so again they had second thoughts about keeping a pregnant woman back, and they sent her after him. So I wrote to him, and he wrote back and said that yes, he would like to translate it, and that's how I met him.
Are you still playing the saxophone?
No, unfortunately I don't, because, you know, I had respiratory troubles. I had to quit when I was about 25 or so.
Been that long since you picked
up
a...
I couldn't blow it anymore, you know. I had bronchitis and things, so...
You still listen a lot?
Oh, yes, I listen, of course. I have a large collection of LPs, mainly Czech jazz featuring American soloists. This is an interesting series, you know. People don't know much about it here, but, you know, Prague is one of the European cities which is very welcoming to jazzmen. And since jazz is no longer a popular form of music, I mean, it's not a mass phenomenon. You know, jazz has a small following of aficionados. So sometimes these American traveling classics, you know, who can only make a living by traveling from city to city and performing in nightclubs and so on, sometimes they get invited to Prague and they record with a local group. And these recordings are very interesting, you know, the confrontation of someone like Wild Bill Davison, you know, or people like that, you know, living classics, playing against the background of a Czech group that calls itself Classic Jazz Collegium, you know, students of music who play. So I listen to jazz every day. In fact, whenever I read a book or when I write, I always have jazz in the background.
You hear O'Danny prefigured in an earlier novel, didn't he?
O'Danny appears in quite a few novels of mine. He's a sort of theme that goes through many books. He first appeared in The Cowards. He's the hero of The Cowards. And not only Danny, but many of the characters in The Engineer are in The Cowards. Both the girls, you know, Irene and Maria, are in The Cowards, and then the boys in the band are there. And then he appeared in that Tank Corps, the military novel, where he's in the army. And in another novel called The Swell Season, and in several other pieces.
It's amusing, some of the episodes Danny has with the students in his class. You're still teaching, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Tell me about a little bit about the students that you teach and what it's like.
Well, you know, I was surprised by the reaction of some of the Canadian reviewers who were quite angry with me and who thought that I presented the Canadian students as stupid young people. Well, I certainly did not have that intention. There are many people in the class who are not really terribly interested in literature, but they have to take the course. And they are not stupid, they are simply not interested. And then young people are very rarely learned and wise, you know. I know that this sounds perhaps conservative or old-fashioned, but I think that young people in a way are stupid. They are very nice creatures, you know, they are full of idealism and fervor and all that, but they simply have no experience of life.
You have to be at least 40 to be learned and wise.
Of course, and they have no experience of life. And what was mainly held against me by some Canadian feminist critics was that I was smug politically, that they are not that stupid politically. Well, politically stupid. I think it's they are fortunate to be so naive politically, because that means that nothing ever happened to them. I mean, in the sense of having lived under a very brutal dictatorship. And unfortunately, you know, in politics, by which I don't mean, of course, Canadian politics, local politics, but international politics. In politics, the only method of really learning what it is all about is to live under a regime. Most people cannot really experience or cannot imagine what it means to live under a Nazi regime if they did not live under one, you know. Because these things in the totalitarian regimes are so unimaginable for people who have never been exposed to them, that they have a tendency to discard them from their thinking, and they have a tendency to disbelieve people who tell them about the things. You know, it's quite a common phenomenon that if you, as an exile, tell them about, you know, concentration camps and things like that, they say, well, all right, he's an embittered exile, so he's exaggerating. And again, I can understand that, because if you tell them that, let's say, 12 people are sentenced to hang for crimes that later on prove to be non-existent, and the 12 hanged men were rehabilitated in the course of 5 years, it sounds like an invented story. But it's a historical fact, you know. So I don't think that exiles are exaggerating. Well, occasionally some of them are, you know. But basically all the things that we are saying about totalitarian regimes are very well documented, you know. And there are people who, witnesses who were there, you know. My brother-in-law spent 10 years in uranium mines. But he doesn't like to talk about it because nobody believes him, that he was sent to the mines only because he was a Boy Scout.
Well, we're out of time, but I have one last question. You seem to be very comfortably settled in Canada. Any plans to go back to Czechoslovakia?
No, certainly not. Even if I had some, it's hardly possible, because the regime there is well entrenched, and unless something very radical happens in Moscow, I don't foresee any change in the Prague police regime.
Do you think they'd give you a ticker tape parade if you went back? A ticker tape parade if you went back to Prague?
Well, I don't know. By now, of course, you know, people still remember me. It's surprising that even young people write me letters. And just the other day, I spoke to a Canadian who visited Prague and mentioned my name and the university, and the students knew about me, and even some of them even read my novels. But of course, it's been 14 years, and I was a very popular writer, you know. I mean, popular in the sense as here, people simply did read me.
Are your later novels being read in Czechoslovakia?
Well, they are smuggled in, so people who are eager to read them can probably get copies, borrow copies, you know.
It's a pretty big book to smuggle in. How do you get that under your...
Well, we published it as a paperback, you know. So it doesn't look so big in paperback. But of course I'm largely forgotten, you know. I mean, I no longer have that mass following that I had when I was still living there. But of course, this can be easily remedied, you know, if the situation changes, so my books will come out in Czechoslovakia.
Are you sure you're forgotten? Because Danny certainly had a number of visits from
Yes, that's true. Well, I'm not forgotten by the secret police, that's for sure. No, I don't mean that I'm completely forgotten, but, you know, when I was still there, so literally everybody knew me, you know, all the young people, all the reading public, wherever I went, I always had huge crowds, you know, I did readings and things. Well, by now, students remember me, students know me, you know, students who study literature, or people of my generation, or younger. But I have no idea how many people really know about me, you know, I'm sure that many have never heard my name. But then also many people listen to the Voice of America, which is not jammed for some reason. And I have regular reviews of new American books in Czech on the Voice of America. And this is obviously listened to, you know, on a mass scale, because again I get letters from listeners in Czechoslovakia commenting on my reviews. So I'm sure that many people still know me. You know.
Well, you're certainly picking up a lot of North American readers thanks to the Engineer of Human Souls, and I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking to me.
Well, thank you.